Hey, shh. Calm down. The show is about to start.
Reese on the radio.
Turn it up.
Turn it up loud.
Turn it up loud.
Like a dream come true.
Turn on your radio. Reese is on the radio.
Yo, let's get it.
Due to the nature of this program, discretion does not exist.
It's Reese on the radio right now on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Hello! If I haven't told you folks, I love being in the studio now. What's going on, all you scallywags? Nutmeggers! Everybody! Across the fruited plain!
It's Reese on the radio on WTIC News Talk 1080. Happy Thursday to you, and I know we're about to wrap this puppy up, this whole day up. We have got a jam-packed show for you today to talk about only a few topics. And I promised you yesterday that I would get in-depth on it today. But just to preview today's show, we've got Chris Powell on the program later on, columnist. ChrisPowellColumn.com for all of his writing. So he'll be on a program at 4 o'clock to talk about his latest article on homelessness, on the housing crisis, as they're calling it. I'm going to go in another direction today. I think we're being bamboozled, but we'll talk about that. And we'll talk about it with Chris. Chris is going to set us up for my monologue as it comes to affordable housing, as it relates to affordable housing in the state. And this has been an issue for me because there are certain things that just didn't add up, and Chris Powell's article just certified what I was thinking. And so we'll talk to him. I'll let you know about all of that. I've got one topic that will dovetail into another. And that's the DCF issue as it relates to the Waterbury case and Mimi Torres's case, and then how that dovetails into homeschooling, which is an article that I read today from Newsweek. And there's so much to all of that. So jam-packed but very limited on topics, plus your phone calls at 860-522-WTIC, 860-522-9842. I want to thank my wife for bailing on me while I was in the gym today. She picked up a couple of weights. She got in the elliptical. She didn't feel comfortable. She was out of it. She said, yeah, I'm just going. After she forced me to work out this morning, which I did. I did work out this morning. I broke a sweat. And I was telling Roland, I don't feel myself today. I ate avocado in the morning. I don't eat avocado anytime. But my wife gave me about half a avocado to eat this morning with some eggs and some bacon. I had to have coffee with no sugar. We're part-time fasting, so therefore we eat every 12 hours. This is to bring my weight down a little bit. I'll admit, I've gained a few pounds. But she bailed on me in the gym this morning. She said, you know what? I'll come out. I'll be here later. You have fun. The objective, and I got it. She didn't have to fool me. She gave me the impression, I want you to come work out with me. And, of course, I don't want to disappoint my wife. I wake up in the morning. I get dressed. She goes, what are you doing? We're going to the gym. I thought we're doing a gym thing. Okay, gets up. I get in the gym. I start getting a rhythm. She turns around and says, yeah, you know, I'm going to come later. Now, I can't quit now because I'm not a quitter. Well, unless it's cigarettes and booze, but you know what I mean. So I got to look like, you know, I can do it. So I do it. I work out for a half an hour, and I mean, a good sweat. Watching Fox News, getting my morning on, drinking a hot cup of coffee with no sugar. She tells me I'm going to get used to it. I think yeah, she's lying. She's flat out lying. I'm not getting used to it. Coffee without sugar, it's just muddy water. That's all it is. There's no taste to it. Just tastes like dirty water. I'd rather just drink water, which is probably what I'm going to end up doing from now on. I'm just going to have to get up the old natural way. I'm not going to inject myself with caffeine. I'm just going to drink water.
No, there's things you have a little energy drink or something like that.
I won't do those things. Those things give me the jitters.
All right, so then Google some ingredients to make your own
from fruit. Scratch, yeah.
And then boom, you got it.
Okay. Last time I had an energy drink, I was hosting a hip hop concert in Boston. Was it Dos Effects, Chubb Rock, and I can't remember Ed OG from Ed OG and the Bulldogs was up there as well. He co-hosted with me. Anyway, the only thing they had to drink was Diet Red Bull. I drank so many of those things by the end of the day, I felt like somebody dipped my whole body in a glass of Alka-Seltzer. I had fuzziness all over. I felt like I was jittery.
Yeah, you're not supposed to drink that many.
Yeah, I think I had about 12.
Yeah, not in one day.
It was the only thing they had to drink.
Those energy drinks don't do anything for me.
No?
No, I don't get energized or anything. I get tired.
Yeah, they were the diet ones, and at first I said, oh my God, this is awful. By the fifth can, I was like, nah, those will do.
I don't drink alcohol, so I use Red Bull as like my alcoholic drink.
Oh, is that
drink.
Your
so,
alcoholic
so
beverage?
So when I go to like a restaurant, they ask me if I want a drink. I say, yes. Do you have Red Bull? And they say, yeah. And I said, yeah, can you mix Red Bull with a pineapple juice, please? And that's my...
I'll have a Red Bull on the rocks.
Red Bull on the rocks with pineapple juice. Thank you.
Anyway, so yeah, Roland keeps telling me I'm going to feel better. I doubt it. So I'm just going to drink water. I'm going to come to grips. Look, I don't smoke anymore. I'm going to, in March, it'll be 5 years since I had a cigarette. Not bad, right? I should applaud myself. Why not? 5 years without a cigarette. Next year, next June, will be 7 years without a drink. So, I mean, if I could do all of that, I'm sure I can give up sugar and fun. You know, a clinical psychiatrist told me what I said. It was like, you know what? I've been off of alcohol for about a year. I said, you know what? I'm going to try cigarettes. The woman looked at me. She said, okay, slow down. Don't get ahead of yourself. Next thing you know, you're talking about you can fly. She goes, cigarettes are harder to get over than heroin. I was like, what? Now, having never done heroin, I didn't know what to gauge it off of, but I tried it anyway. And here we are, almost 5 years later. And I don't think about it. Roseanne smokes from time to time, and people I know smoke. In fact, my boys, you know, at my moving company, they smoked all the time. It took me 2 years to get over the hankering, like the urge, but I got through it. Now, when people smoke around me, I don't even get the urge to smoke. Alcohol, same thing. Walk through the, you know, wine aisle, because a big wine guy back in the day, or the beer aisle, no triggers. It's like, nope, I'm good. So maybe I can with sugar. If I give myself a chance, I think it's quite possible. Anyway, everyone is in the chat room ended up in the ER with drinking energy drinks. Goodness gracious, Wendy. Mike says, holy hell, it's sugar. Lemmy smoked 2 packs a day, a fifth of Jack a day, and lived on fried meat and cheese. Live a little. Look, I know that Lemmy did all of those things. He lived to a ripe old age. Okay? I'm not. And Lemmy, it's funny because what was that meme of Charlie Sheen? And there's another meme of, goodness gracious, the guitarist from Rolling Stones, Keith Richards. And he... when Lamar Odom went on his bender, and there's a meme that says Keith Richards goes, he goes, smoke crack, got drunk, and hung out with hookers. He goes, we call that a Tuesday. And Lamar Odom had a heart attack.
Yeah,
doing those things.
I have an uncle that it's crazy how biology works because he did a lot of drugs.
Yeah,
and he lived a long time, and his body was just used to him doing a certain amount of these different drugs.
Yeah.
And once he finally decided, you know what, I'm going to get clean, his body rejected it and he passed away.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
Like his body had actually acclimated and just became accustomed to the drugs in its system, yep, and worked its way out.
And kept him alive.
Kept him alive. And then he cut it off and the body said, don't recognize this guy. Yep. Shut her down.
Yep. And that's what happened. I was like, wow.
Yeah, funny how that happens.
A year after he got clean and sober, a year later he was out of there.
Holy moly. Interesting. That's a crazy, yeah. I can totally understand that. Anyway, I just wanted to make that clear. So if I'm a little irritable today, it might be because of that. I'm trying something new. I'm trying to get used to it. All right. Let me begin with the opening monologue by saying this. Why is it that social justice is never extended to the children? Has anyone ever wondered that? There is never a social justice program for children. When we talk about social justice as of late, children have even been blamed for the things that people have complained about in the argument of social justice. You might remember Coca-Cola had these folks come into their corporate office telling them about anti-racism programs. And in the anti-racism programs, they were suggesting that your infant child and or toddler were showing signs of racism, even at that young of an age. And that you were responsible for it because you were genetically predisposed as a child, that if your parents were white, you are going to grow up to be racist. It is also the case when it comes to transgenderism or, I don't know, sexuality in general. There always seem to be sacrificing the kids and especially their innocence. They tell children that they are innocent and they can't make decisions for themselves unless, of course, it's what gender they are, or whether or not they should remove their genitalia. They all seem to be the ones that we take the social justice out on. We need to invent things that jeopardize children's innocence. Putting pornographic books in libraries. Having drag queens come to classrooms for story hour. What social justice is applied to children in any of these cases that benefits them? Nope. It all benefits the adults. Usually social justice affects the children most in a negative way. And we've been investigating lately, folks, as it relates to Mimi Torres, that social justice may have played a huge role in her death. And in many cases, the death of plenty of children. I am not suggesting that anyone is setting out to kill kids. But what I'm saying is, for the sake of social justice, they are putting children in harm's way because they are the last individuals who are ever considered when talking about social justice. It's about adults. It just is. The Mimi Torres story shows me something very interesting. So hear me out. What we know in Connecticut, just Connecticut, is that we have politicians who are actively protecting a group of people primarily based on their ethnicity. You see, when they're talking about illegals in the state of Connecticut, they're not talking about Afghan illegals. They're not even talking about Haitian illegals. They are predominantly speaking of Hispanic and Latino. Why? Because a majority of those who have come across the border illegally and have ended up in the state and in other places, but I'm just talking about Connecticut, tend to be Hispanic or Latino. And when you are trying to protect that community from scrutiny or bad press, who do you protect? Not the children. Because what do we know? How many times have we seen a story? Danbury, Hamden, Newington, New Britain, Bristol, Hartford. How many of the individuals who have been arrested have been charged for harming children? And how often are those stories swept under the rug? You have to find out about them on national news networks or maybe conservative-leaning media here in the state. You never hear the politicians who protect those groups ever say that it is shameful and it is horrible that those individuals were doing those things to those children and those people need to get out of here. You will never see a press conference with any of these guys. And yes, I'm talking to you, John Larson. Yes, I'm talking to you, Rosa DeLauro. Yes, I'm talking to you, Dick Blumenthal. Yes, I'm talking to you, Matt Lesser. Chris Murphy, too. There has never been a press conference of these folks who were saying, yes, these guys were bad. They were harming kids. But that doesn't mean that you sweep up everyone. Because I can get down with that argument. Some of these people are innocent. These guys who did the crazy stuff, hurting kids, no. Those guys got to go. In fact, hold on. Give me a minute. I'll drive downtown with you. But no, they're ignored. Why? Because social justice is social justice. The kids be damned. The social justice is more important than the children. And Mimi Torres fell right into that trap. When we come back, I'm going to explain it to you. How social justice killed Mimi Torres and plenty of other kids in the state of Connecticut. In my opinion, through the neglect of DCF, protecting social justice, but not the children. And I have their own statements in my hand to prove it. We will not make any speculations. We will use their own platform to make the case. Go nowhere. More news, more views, and more on this topic when we return. It's Reese on the Radio on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Fan of WTIC? Then do us a favor. Download the free Odyssey app and favorite WTIC.
All right, we're back. Reese on the Radio, WTIC News Talk 1080. Quickly, I want to give a shout out to Peggy. Thank you, Peggy. Peggy gave me some alternatives for sugar and some other additives. I forwarded them to my wife. She is saying thank you as well. She just sent that to me. And I also want to thank Catherine M. For the kind words and thank you. Comparing me to my hero in any way whatsoever, forget about it. Warms my heart, and you're number one in my book automatically just for making that comparison. So thank you so much for that. You didn't have to, but thank you. Catherine said that it took a little time for me to grow on her, but she loves the show. And I expect that. I'm not typical. It isn't a typical show, and I knew that from the outset. I think that's what garnered the attention of WTIC when they brought me here. It was like, yeah, it kind of does radio different. And I'm glad they recognized it, and I'm glad you did too, Catherine, as many of you have. And she also stated that at the beginning of the show, Roland, when we played the line from and the land of the free and the home of the brave. She stops whatever she's doing. She puts her hand over her heart at the beginning of this show. Yeah, that's that was the reason why I put it there. It's because it's my favorite part of the Star Spangled Banner. So that's why I put it there. Anyway, let's get to this part of the conversation. Her name is Susan Hamilton. She is the current head of the Department of Children and Families here in Connecticut. She serves as the interim commissioner, appointed by Governor Ned Lamont in September of this year. Hamilton holds a Master of Social Work degree and a Juris Doctorate. She previously led the department from 2007 to 2011 and has been its general counsel since 2023. This followed the retirement of former Commissioner Jody Hill-Lilly in August of this year. As of November of 2025, no permanent replacement has been announced. So now we understand where we are and how we got here as far as Ms. Hamilton is concerned. This is what it says about Ms. Hamilton's background at DCF and her background as a child protection defense attorney. From 2014 to 2023, Hamilton served as a public defender and eventually director of delinquency defense and child protection for Connecticut's Division of Public Defender Services. In this capacity, she supervised attorneys, social workers, and investigators representing children, parents, and families in juvenile court matters involving DCF investigations. The work inherently involves challenging DCF petitions for child removal. I'll say it again. This work inherently involves challenging DCF petitions for child removal, neglect findings, or termination of parental rights, civil actions that can sometimes escalate to criminal charges for parents if evidence of abuse emerges. Her focus here was on protecting parental rights and ensuring fair processes, which aligns with cautious approach to state intervention, but doesn't equate to blanket opposition to prosecution in several cases. Now, that doesn't mean that she is gung-ho in charging families, but she is working as an advocate to end child removal when DCF recommends it. Why would anybody do that? Policies and statements as a DCF commissioner from 2007 to 2011. During her first term as commissioner, Hamilton helped develop Connecticut's differential response system, a framework that screens hotline reports of abuse or neglect. Low-risk cases, about 40% of the reports, are diverted from formal investigation routes, which often involve home visits, interviews, and potential court referrals, to voluntary support services like family counseling or referrals to nonprofits. Families can decline these without penalty, reducing the likelihood of escalation to prosecution, or removal. This model, later fully implemented by her successor, emphasizes prevention and family unity over punitive measures. In response to criticism over a 2010 neglect case in Torrington, Hamilton stated, "The safety of children is our paramount concern. The department works to keep families together whenever that can be accomplished safely. She acknowledged concern about the DCF's interventions and committed to reviewing them, underscoring a preference for supportive rather than stricter prosecutorial responses. In legislative testimonies as a public defender on bills related to juvenile rights and statements, Hamilton advocated for stronger protections against coercive police or DCF questioning of minors, arguing that children need parental or guardian involvement to ensure voluntary decisions. While this focuses more on youth rights than parents, it reflects a systemic push for due process in child welfare cases, potentially limiting evidence that could support parental prosecutions. No records found her testifying against prosecutions in general. Her comments consistently balance child protection with family rights without rejecting accountability for abuse. But this is the best part. In summary, the rumor about Ms. Hamilton being a defender of parents and not children, it's rooted in her defender background and family-centered policies, which could be seen as anti-prosecution, in the sense of favoring alternatives to court action. However, this is more accurately prescribed as pro-preservation and evidence-based intervention, not opposition to holding parents accountable in high-risk situations. If new details emerge, this could evolve. This is a breakdown of DCF cases in the past 10 years. Why are they relevant? Well, we noticed a pattern. Let's run through a few. In the past 10 years, reports to DCF are between 50,000 and 68,000 in the state. In 2024, the exact number was 67,795, with 40 to 50% accepted for response. Only half of them were responded to by DCF. Removals. They peaked in 2019 between 1,500 and 2,000 removals. That number currently sits at 800 to 1,000, with a focus on kinship care and reunification. That is Mimi Torres's case. Children in placement point in time at the end of the fiscal year. It declined in 2015 at 4,200 to just 2,800 in 2024. This is an incredible drop in children in placement. For what reason would that drop, almost half, happen in that time? We looked into it. In 2021, the continued decline in kinship placements, DCF prioritized those cases for people of color. Why? Because at the time, the percentage of people who were in the system were 32% white, 23% black, 39% Hispanic. Only 6% Asian. I say again, 32% in 2021 were white, 23 were black, 39 were Hispanic. The next year, in 2022, they noticed a disproportionate amount of black cases being sent to DCF. Those numbers declined from 2021, but they skyrocketed in 2022 for Hispanics. The number, in fact, from 2021 to 2024, the percentage rate went from 39 to 42% of all cases in the Hispanic community. 39, 40, 41, 42. What would have caused that kind of increase? a percentage point every year during 2021, 2022, 2023, and 2024. In that same year, ladies and gentlemen, the white community, the number was 32% to 31% to 30% to 29%. How about the black community? 2021 to 2024, the number was 23% to 22% to 21% to 20%. Whites and blacks, as far as DCF intervention, was declining. Hispanics went up 1% year to year. Why? Why? It's worth the question, isn't it? I think it's better than that. I think it's worth an answer. More and more people in every other community going down. Only Hispanics going up. And we had an administration that didn't want police intervention, but fought for reunification of parents. We'll come back. We'll break the rest of this down when we return. Stand by. It's Reese on the Radio.
It's Reese on the Radio on News Talk 1080 WTIC.
Now, I play all of this stuff for you, folks. If you're sticking around, we're talking about DCF and its efforts to keep parents involved with the children who are being seen by DCF, trying to keep the police out of the system. Trying to keep the police out of it. They don't want police involvement. They don't want prosecution of parents. For whatever reason that is, it's only harming the children. This is nothing more than restorative justice. Why? Because if a certain group of people sees an increase in DCF calls and cases, somebody has decided that this is in some way a disenfranchising exercise. And this is all of their data I'm reading, not mine. I didn't find this so I can smear them. This is their own data. And they're the ones who make it clear that they wish to, for equity reasons, they need to decline the amount of people who are removed. In one case, in 2023, 900 equity audits show 20% fewer black removals. They're working on that, keeping the kids from being removed. What happened in 2023? Well, was it 2022? Nonetheless, if you have an active participation in protecting the status quo or not ruffling feathers as it relates to race, you are putting children in jeopardy. And they know this. Of course they know this. But it was them. It was in their own mission statements. Federal audit flags ongoing black overrepresentation. This was their audit in 2023. This is their own reviews. Since 2019, DCF's racial justice goal, one of seven strategic priorities, includes de-identifying race in removal decisions, reducing black removals 20%. Who cares whether or not you're reducing black removals? In order to do that, you have to actually neglect the abuse that's happening in the child's life, don't you? That's the effort. So when Len Bestoff does this piece on NBC Connecticut, and who's the chief's name? I'm forgetting his name. Melanson, Chief Paul Melanson, said this in his piece. It was a teaser that Len Bestoff put out on NBC, but it didn't end up being in the final cut, which I was ticked off because I went to NBC Connecticut's website to go find it. Len had to send it to me personally so that I can have it for the show. And I thank Len for sending it to me. But this is an important thing to note. Again, this is from the Farmington police chief. Listen to what he said about the police when they went to Mimi Torres' house for a noise complaint.
The chief said his officers had no way of knowing a child was missing or that the Department of Children and Families had a history with Garcia.
But we work well together when DCF understands that there was a crime involved. But until that point that they've determined, you know, that there's a crime or suspect that there's a crime, really there's not that collaboration. And so that does become sometimes an issue. So it is, I think, something that we will talk about. How can we better communicate, now with the issue that occurred in Waterbury, now with the issue that occurred here in Farmington, how can we better communicate when, there's a child that maybe is, we'll say, unaccounted for?
And that's all, and all the police chief is saying here is that if there was a coordination, if there was some way that the two would be involved, DCF and the police, they would have showed up and they would have had it there. They've got arrest warrants. Those individuals, they're looking them up in the event of a domestic violence issue. If that person has a warrant, if that person has a restraining order, by getting those folks' names, they run them through the system. You know the police do. Hey, I got John Johnson and John Insurance. Yeah, just check him out for me. Yeah, he comes back with two warrants for domestic violence. Oh, yeah, you know what? Come with us, big guy. That's why. So why wouldn't DCF? Because the DCF doesn't want the police involved. And we know that. That's coming from them. They don't want the police involved. And if we're talking about Mimi's Law, if DCF really wants to change, if they want any reform, because remember, we're talking about a DCF complaint that may put lives in danger. Remember, that's the whole point. Like, DCF is not getting involved for something silly like the kid won't do his homework. When DCF is involved, we're talking about child neglect, which in my view is a crime already. Right? I mean, if you've got DCF involvement and someone is calling about it, in essence, a DCF complaint, a DCF complaint is about the welfare of a child. How is it not criminally related? In any way, an investigation must ensue for what? For what? Whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, there has to be, at least for the parent, if they're doing something that is neglectful, that puts the child in harm's way, you at least have to have the parent know, hey, if I don't feed my kid, if I don't, you know, properly take care of my kid, I could possibly be hemmed up for that. But if DCF is working interference for the family or the parent, for that matter, to make sure that they don't get in trouble with the law, that's not benefiting the kid at all. And you can't be doing it for stats, not for racial stats even. That's reckless. I don't know how else to put it. We'll take a break. We'll lay out some more of this stuff. Let's get to the WTIC newsroom. It's Reese on the radio on News Talk 1080 WTIC.